This is Audible.
Spycraft, the secret history of the CIA's spy techs from communism to Al-Qaeda. By Robert Wallace and H. Keith Melton, with Henry Robert Schlesinger. Narrated by David Drummond. Section 4. Let the Walls Have Ears. Chapter 12. Cold Beer, Cheap Hotels, and a Voltmeter. If it ain't audio, it ain't shit. Unofficial motto of audio techs. They were called audio techs, and for more than two decades, from the 1960s until the 1980s, they were at the top of an unofficial OTS caste system, aggressively mounting hundreds of audio surveillance operations around the world. These few hundred officers worked on the front line of Cold War espionage. Their missions took them from European capitals to the most remote destinations on the globe, responding to stations that saw an opportunity to collect audio. Although CIA audio operations inside the borders of the primary Cold War hard targets, the USSR, China, Cuba, North Korea, and North Vietnam, were severely limited by internal security services, conditions in Europe and Third World countries were far different. In these countries, clandestine audio operations could be launched against the residential quarters, official buildings, and embassy compounds of the hard target countries. This was particularly true in the Third World, where security was often less stringent than in major European cities. When operations levied a requirement, it was expected a tech would catch the next plane for Paris, Rome, West Berlin, or a Third World country in turmoil whose new name had yet to be printed on maps or the new leader's visage on currency. The techs worked under aliases as businessmen, military personnel, or adventure-seeking vacationers, becoming whatever allowed them to blend in with other travelers and provided the most effective cover. A tech might get off a plane in a South Asian country, spend a week planting a bug, then fly home for the weekend, change identities, and find himself in Africa by Monday evening. Their exploits and sophisticated gadgetry rivaled the popular fictions of globe-trotting intelligence officers. OTS audio techs slipped into basements and sewers to tap phone and communication lines, moved silently over rooftops, walked narrow beams through the crawl spaces of attics, and scaled the walls of fashionable villas in the dead of night. They were sent into diplomatic compounds, business offices, residences, hotel rooms, limousines, airplanes, and boats to plant audio devices. Accurate and sometimes embellished accounts of their operational adventures established what would become known as the tech culture, eventually defining, for better or for worse, all OTS techs, regardless of their clandestine discipline. Among the most enduring of these professional and personal attributes was the tech's seemingly unwavering fondness for cheap hotels and cold beer. There were practical reasons for what could be perceived as less than sophisticated tastes among these world travelers, who commonly logged more than 100,000 air miles annually and were away from home 150 nights a year. Although government employees on official travel were not permitted to accumulate frequent flyer miles, they were allowed to keep any funds left over from the daily government food and lodging allowance. The resourceful techs found they could supplement their modest salaries by staying at inexpensive hotels, a type of lodging that became known throughout the agency as tech hotels. More important, the tech's choices when it came to accommodations and beverage made sound operational sense. Whereas case officers traveling abroad needed to match their selection of accommodations with their cover position and operational role, techs usually wanted to get in and out of town while keeping the lowest possible profile. As a rule, they maintained erratic schedules, working when the target was accessible, regardless of time, weather, or holidays. If that meant access to a consulate or embassy could be obtained only after it closed for business, then the tech's workday would likely begin at nightfall and end before dawn. Whatever bargain lodgings may have lacked in comfort or basic amenities, such as heat, hot water, or a private bathroom, they made up for by way of discretion. Luxury or business traveler hotels tended to boast large, attentive staffs that would notice an American businessman leaving late in the evening and returning in the early hours of the morning with traces of plaster dust on his shoes or paint flecks in his hair. On the other hand, tech hotel staff conveniently overlooked the comings and goings of their guests. If an American departed in the early evening and returned just before dawn with his hair matted with sweat and in need of a bath, it would not have been the first time such a thing happened. One technical operations officer realized he had ventured too far down the hostelry pecking order when the desk clerk asked incredulously, "You mean you want the room for the entire night?" Another tech found his own limits of frugality tested when he and his partner checked into a hotel offering a double bed for $350 a night. "You know, if we shared a room, we could cut the cost in half," the aggressively thrifty tech suggested. As for their reputed penchant for beer, well, beer just tasted good and made other deficiencies seem less important. It was also safe. In countries where drinking the local water was a health risk, beer served double duty as thirst-quenching beverage and water for brushing teeth. During one operation that confined six techs in a Target facility for several days, the team member in charge of providing food provisioned generous quantities of beer, canned tuna, and nothing else. In the sweltering heat of the empty warehouse, the odor produced by a sustained diet of tuna and beer led to a unanimous vote to prohibit that particular tech from outfitting the team with provisions again. Ever. Despite living and working in these austere conditions, techs brought technical magic to operations. Their sophisticated gear tapped into secrets hidden behind the high walls and closed doors of secure installations. Their equipment, combined with expert installation, captured the private conversations of people to whom the agency had no other access. The moods, personal doubts, and aspirations of potential recruitment targets held on reels of audio tape offered case officers a unique peek into their professional and personal world. Recordings of official discussions of policy and diplomatic strategies provided CIA analysts and policymakers with well-sourced, hard strategic intelligence as well as tactical counterintelligence that supported law enforcement. None of this was lost on the techs themselves, neither the excitement of the operations nor the value of the intelligence take. "If it ain't audio, it ain't shit," became their unofficial motto, and was proudly displayed on the desk of the audio chief during the 1970s. They were the top guns of the OTS, and none of them doubted it for a second. However, the colorful tech culture, the technology, and the intelligence that flowed from it did not materialize overnight. The advanced technology, like the tech culture, evolved over two decades. The devices, as well as the expertise to make them work, were built from the ground up. The technical services staff was not a year old in 1952 when the CIA received information about an alarming audio discovery in Moscow. During an electronic sweep, the countermeasures team discovered a device secreted in the wooden replica of the Great Seal of the United States that hung behind Ambassador George Kennan's desk in his residence at Spasso House, barely a mile from the Kremlin, at No. 10 Spasso-Peshkovskaya Square. The seal had been hanging there 7 years, after a group of Soviet young pioneers presented it as a token of friendship on July 4, 1945, to then U.S. Ambassador W. Averell Harriman. The gift, presented by smiling children in neatly pressed uniforms, concealed a listening device that would baffle and frustrate the agency for years. "The Englishmen will die of envy," Valentin Bereshkov, Stalin's personal translator, whispered to Ambassador Harriman during presentation. That the Soviets bugged the U.S. ambassador's office should have come as no surprise to anyone. When American diplomats first arrived in Moscow in 1934, they discovered that listening devices inside their offices and residences would be the way of life within the Soviet Union. U.S. Ambassador Llewellyn Thompson, posted to Moscow between 1957 and 1962 and again between 1966 and 1969, would walk in Red Square for private conversations. As a young diplomat in the 1930s, Kennan personally played amateur spy hunter in Spasso House by hiding in the billiard room overnight, with a partner in the attic, in an unsophisticated attempt to catch the Soviet techs planting devices. Further evidence of the Soviets' use of eavesdropping was demonstrated by the NKVD's, forerunner to the KGB, aggressive operations during World War II. In the late fall of 1941, as German forces approached Moscow, the Soviet government ordered foreign diplomats out of the city to the relative safety of Kuibyshev, Samara. Then, with foreign embassies standing empty or hosting only skeleton staffs, the NKVD hardwired virtually every Western embassy in the city with embedded microphones. After the German army's advance halted just 20 miles outside Moscow in early 1942, the diplomats were allowed to return to the Soviet capital and their bugged embassies. The NKVD bugged the rooms and conversations of President Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Churchill during the Tehran and Yalta summit meetings. In Tehran, in 1943, Stalin maneuvered the American president into staying in the Russian compound amid rumors of a German assassination plot. At the 1945 Yalta conference, the NKVD techs employed an early version of a directional microphone to capture Roosevelt's private outdoor conversations at a distance of 50 to 100 meters. When Churchill's daughter, Sarah, made an offhand comment that lemons might be just the thing with caviar, in another version of the story, Sarah suggested lemons with tea, a lemon tree reportedly appeared in the orchard overnight. After receiving the audio take from these operations, Stalin pushed his intelligence service for more and more information, insisting they report even the tone of voice in transcripts. After devouring the raw intelligence delivered each morning with his breakfast, Stalin would then act taciturn, even bored, during the actual meetings. However, what was discovered hanging behind the ambassador's desk in 1952 was revolutionary in the technology of listening devices. Implanted in the middle of the carved wood of the Great Seal, cleverly hidden behind an air passage formed by the American Eagle's nostril, was a device that was alarming as much for the technology it employed as the fact it had been active for more than half a decade. Indeed, four American ambassadors, Avril Harriman, Walter Smith, Alan Kirk, and George Kennan, presumably had their secret conversations picked up by the bug. Differing significantly in design and function from any piece of covert listening equipment previously known, the device was constructed of precision-tooled steel and comprised a long, pencil-thin antenna with a short cylindrical top. Agency engineers could not understand exactly how it worked. The standalone unit, apparently, did not require a battery or any other visible power source. It had no wires or tubes, nothing that identified the device as a piece of electronic equipment. If the oddly shaped length of metal was transmitting conversations, then how was it doing it? The Thing, as it was soon dubbed, bounced among the agency's lab, the FBI, and private contractors for evaluation and reverse engineering. No one could offer anything beyond an educated guess as to how the thing worked, and somewhere in its travels from lab to lab, it was damaged from either improper handling or shipping. The Thing was eventually sent to Peter Wright, the principal scientist for MI5, the British intelligence service responsible for counterintelligence operations. Wright worked for more than 2 months to solve the mystery before eventually coaxing it into operation. He dubbed it a passive cavity resonator. The Thing, as Wright discovered, worked by reflecting radio waves, then picking those echoes up with a radio receiver. To operate the device, the NKVD aimed a continuous 800 megahertz radio signal at the seal from a listening post in the building across from Spasso House. The Thing's thin diaphragm at the top, which Wright had repaired, vibrated with the sound of a voice. Those vibrations were carried by an interior tuning post to the antenna. Then, as the vibrations hit the antenna, they altered the reflected radio signal that bounced back to the listening post. The Thing did not require internal power, In the same way, a mirror does not require power to reflect light. The radio transmitter and receiver, codenamed LOSS, or Reindeer by the Russian techs, were a marvel of signal processing, considering the technology available at the time. According to Wright's own account, once he understood the principle and made the device work, he took another 18 months to create a similar system for British intelligence. Called SATER, his device featured aerials, transmitter and receiver, disguised as two proper British umbrellas. SATER proved to be a great success, and Wright called it black magic. Then, as he observed, the Americans promptly ordered 12 sets, and rather cheekily copied the drawings and made 20 more. The American version of the device, according to Wright, was called Easy Chair, also Mark II and Mark III. The concept behind the thing represented a remarkable leap forward in eavesdropping technology. Viewed as a wake-up call at CIA for audio operations, it was the clandestine equivalent to Sputnik. The agency had to play technological catch-up in RF audio as well as in space. Ironically, although they did not know it at the time, many of the scientists who had worked and failed to decipher the thing's mystery would probably have recognized the name of its creator, Lev Sergeyevich Theremin. A musical prodigy and physicist, Theremin was born in Tsarist Russia in the late 1800s, excelled at some of Russia's finest universities, and his genius was recognized by the Soviet regime. He lived in New York City during the 1920s and 1930s, where he demonstrated the electronic instrument that bore his name. The theremin was played without touching it, and enjoyed a brief life as a serious instrument. In the 1930s, it captured the imagination of the avant-garde of the jazz age, though eventually it was relegated to creating the spooky sounds heard in horror and science fiction films. Those who crowded ballrooms and concert halls to hear Theremin's thoroughly modern instrument, or caught glimpses of him amid Manhattan's high society, never suspected that the socially sophisticated Russian genius was also covertly working for Soviet intelligence. Just before the Soviet Union's entry into World War II, Stalin summoned Theremin back to Moscow, where he was summarily sent to a Siberian prison camp. Later, he was transferred into one of the KGB's secret laboratories, a Sharashka, to work on creating spy gear. After developing the thing, Theremin was awarded one of the Soviet Union's highest honors, the Stalin Prize First Class, along with the equivalent of $20,000, a fortune in Soviet society, but remained imprisoned. At its formation in September of 1951, the CIA technical services staff employed fewer than 50 people. Its scientists and engineers were housed in a makeshift lab at Indian Head, Maryland, 30 miles south of Washington, D.C. The facility, a one-time gun test facility for the Navy, sat on a large peninsula that jutted out into the Potomac. Somehow, the agency begged, borrowed, or stole some space down there, but conditions were bad. We had to do our own janitorial service. We complained, but we did it, remembered Kurt Beck, an engineer who worked in that first lab. When we started, there were a dozen people overall, and maybe 6 to 8 people working in the audio program. The thing arrived at the TSS lab in 1952, but the audio engineers had no point of reference against which to assess the device or understand how it worked. Data on covert listening and transmitting devices, comparable to research on military weapon systems or private sector consumer products, simply did not exist. Cataloging data on technical collection devices was a new concept for American intelligence, and the Soviet passive resonator technology exceeded anything TSS could even attempt. However, like all finds, discoveries of clandestine devices, the thing revealed certain key capabilities of its host service. The first was the cleverness of design. The thing demonstrated that Soviet intelligence possessed a technical expertise not matched by the CIA. Second, the construction suggested that the Soviet engineering approach relied on creating one-off, custom-made pieces specifically produced for each operation. The device was not mass-produced or made in a serial production of 50 or 100 identical units with interchangeable components. To the TSS engineers, the thing looked to be expertly crafted and built entirely by hand. The thing underscored deficiencies in U.S. technical capabilities compared to the Soviets, as well as highlighting some Soviet weak points, such as a lack of technical innovations spurred by a consumer-based economy. Without private industries to offset some of the costs of building laboratories or production facilities, the Soviet's intelligence service had to underwrite all the costs for developing spy gear. This contrasted sharply to the OSS tradition of recruiting private industry to support intelligence. There could also be little doubt that the thing was the product of Russia's long involvement with espionage dating back to the time of the Tsars, while America's espionage capability, particularly in the technological sense, was still in its infancy. The engineers at Indian Head recognized the huge gap, as well as the larger, more basic, and immediate question facing them. Precisely, how do you go about building a better bug? The state of available technology in the 1950s limited the CIA's audio operations to little more than running a microphone wire or a telephone line to a set of headphones. Even among the war surplus equipment, there was little of real value. The OSS technical staff had concentrated its efforts on creating special weapons and explosive devices for equipping partisan forces and operatives behind enemy lines. Few of the wartime agency's resources were devoted to technical aids for agent operations, and even less to developing eavesdropping equipment. The U.S. Army Signal Corps had produced a bugging kit, but at more than a decade old, it was sorely outdated. While some equipment, such as microphones and amplifiers, was available on the commercial market, these devices were bulky and generally not suitable for covert duty. As a result, the agency's supply of devices was limited to obsolete military surplus and whatever Kurt and his colleagues could scrounge, assemble, or modify from the telephone company or recording industry. There was also little experience among the TSS staff. Most of the engineers, like Kurt, were just out of college and in their mid-20s or a little older if they had served in the war. The older TSS engineers' wartime experience tended toward equipment like radar, sonar, and large shipboard systems rather than clandestine audio surveillance. It would take the young engineers time and trial and error to learn the new business of covert audio operations. And the world was on the verge of a technological revolution that put them in the right place at precisely the right time. In 1947, scientists at Bell Labs demonstrated the germanium transistor and patented it the next year. By 1952, transistors were being used in specialty devices, such as hearing aids and military systems. 2 years later, Texas Instruments, along with a small Indianapolis company, IDEA, introduced the first transistorized pocket radio. Called the Regency TR-1, it sold for $49.95 and appeared in stores just in time for Christmas. The age of the transistor had arrived. Through these electronic miracles, everyday consumer electronics could now be made smaller, less power-hungry, and more reliable. For clandestine operations, the transistor's impact would prove equally profound. The same transistor, solid-state technology, that allowed teenagers to listen to Elvis at the beach would provide the foundation for new capabilities in audio surveillance operations. Yet the transistor solved only half the problem for the CIA. TSS still lacked the necessary in-house laboratory facilities and engineering expertise to conduct basic development work and the funding to pay for it. In response, TSS revived the OSS model of forming classified partnerships with industry and academia to develop technology, then contracting with companies to design and produce the systems. In the booming post-war economy, competition was keen, and companies were adding R&D engineers as fast as they could in an effort to feed industrial and consumer markets hungry for innovation. The decision to use classified contracts with private industry seemed a practical way to get the maximum bang for their buck, or in this case, the smallest, most efficient audio devices for the dollar. TSS eagerly adapted new technologies from commercial research as well as spin-offs from the larger government programs to meet its operational requirements. Because of the premium placed on reliability for clandestine devices, TSS bet that conventional and proven equipment, like transistors, microphones, and recorders, which worked well in the consumer and commercial markets, could be repackaged, reduced in size, and adapted to covert use. The same assembly processes used for making consumer products could also be redirected toward the production of spy gear. Companies that lent staff to the OSS during World War II were now asked by TSS for access to their proprietary research and their best engineering minds. At times, it was a tough sell, just as it had been for Stanley Lovell. TSS was not as lucrative as the big-ticket items like satellites, radar systems, missiles, submarines, and airplanes. The needs of TSS were relatively small, decimal dust, compared to billion-dollar military and satellite procurement programs. The CIA did not need production runs of 10,000 or 50,000 units. 50 or 100 small, reliable devices were enough, and the companies could not publicly acknowledge or promote what had been produced. For large companies, in particular, these contracts and their limited production runs were marginally profitable in the short term and offered little potential commercial payoff over the long term. Budgetary troubles severely limited TSS's audio program in the early years. One tech remembers the entire budget for worldwide audio equipment in 1956 was under $200,000, enough to buy a few tape recorders, microphones, and some other commercial equipment, but not nearly enough to mount either an effective engineering effort or aggressive operations. Many of the new prototype devices developed by private contractors and research projects never left the labs, because TSS simply did not have the funds to order even a small production run. Then, in 1957, a CIA Inspector General, IG, report addressed the issue of whether audio surveillance would be a core CIA mission and a primary future method of collecting intelligence. The report urged the DDP and TSS to make audio operations a top priority and forever changed TSS's financial picture. A post-World War II engineer, working in the audio equipment branch at the time, Tom Grant recalled that soon after the IG's report was issued, he received an unannounced visit from a senior CIA official. Asked about the state of audio surveillance equipment, Grant replied that both he and the research staff were frustrated, and then outlined the problems in detail. For instance, when lab equipment broke down, Grant explained, he could not order a new unit because the limited funds available were needed for gear to support ongoing operations. The visitor listened for some time and then abruptly concluded the conversation by saying, "I'm willing to authorize 10 times your current budget." Grant immediately renamed his guest Mr. Moneybags from headquarters. The additional funding for a new program codenamed Earwart arrived in increments as TSS spent it. To the techs, it seemed as if the financial floodgates had opened. Grant's job turned from scrounging the cheapest equipment possible to talking with development engineers about new mechanical and electronic devices to aid clandestine operations and ordering the most promising. Not every item was successful when put to operational testing, but at long last, TSS was seriously in the audio surveillance game. With new equipment coming online, the need for trained engineers to deploy and service the systems around the world was evident. Prior to 1958, TSS had only a handful of technical operations officers capable of planting bugs and setting up listening posts where the audio take was initially processed. Tech equipment, cameras, microphones, and recorders were typically issued to case officers in the same way as concealments and one-time pads. TSS received an equipment order and then delivered the devices to the case officers along with some basic instruction. However, the new, more complex, and delicate devices brought with them the need for an increased expertise. For example, the first over-the-air audio transmitters